The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Now it's 9:23 this Friday morning. In his career, Robert Harris has sold, we reckon about, what, around 10 million novels, Robert, at this point?
I've absolutely no idea, Ryan, to be honest.
Ancient Rome, alternate histories of World War II, modern political intrigue, and now he's back with a novel and certainly unexplored territory in The Second Sleep. I think The Second Sleep brings up everything. It brings up Brexit, it brings up, even though you wouldn't have known at the time necessarily that he was going to be PM, but Boris. It brings it, phones, communication, all of these things. Here's my question, and I was intrigued to ask you before when I finished the book, was what are we to do, you and I, now with regard to talking about your book and the twist?
Well,
do we give the twist away now and get on with it?
I think we have to, Ryan, to be honest. Otherwise, we can hardly talk about the book, and then it's rather frustrating for the listeners, I think. So the reviewers have given it away, so let's give it away.
Okay, so there's a pause there for people who, if they don't want to know, can disappear for the next little while. But in the meantime, I don't like reading reviews. I want to read a book cold. So I didn't, had no idea. I was lured into it, and suddenly in this, what are we out to, what year was
1468.
1468. I thought, God, this is a period of history now that doesn't really do it for me. I hope it's interesting. And suddenly a parakeet appears, a grandfather clock appears, some communication device. And I was thinking of something like the Rosetta Stone or something with the bite of an apple out of it. And I thought, where is this going? Talk to us.
Well, the idea behind The Second Sleep is a title, you know, in pre-industrial times, people used to sleep twice. They used to go to bed early, wake up about 1 a.m, get up, socialise, eat something, and then go back to bed until dawn. And that struck me as a perfect metaphor for what I was trying to write about, which is that the world has lost its technology and that some cataclysm occurred. And the book is not set in 1468, it's actually set 800 years in the future, after our technical civilization has collapsed. And it's about a priest and an antiquarian and a couple of other characters who set out to try and really, like an archaeological dig, to find out what became of us. We've left some ruins behind, we've left motorway bridges and embankments and cooling towers, concrete cooling towers. We've left a lot of plastic bags and straws,
nappies.
And nappies.
And wipes.
But we haven't left any really great buildings, because all these great modern skyscrapers and so on will collapse within 100, 150 years. The modern houses around churches will collapse, but the stone-built churches will survive. So the world has gone back to a kind of medieval, religious-centred existence, but there is this overhang of what became of us. And the whole discussion of science and technology has been outlawed by the church.
What an intriguing premise. I'd love to know, was there one trigger for it, Robert, or was it a series of events?
I think it came to about 6 or 7 years ago, the idea, because I'd written the Roman novels, and I thought it'd be quite interesting to write about people trying to find out about some lost civilization, and it turns out to be us. So that was the starting point. And then I think I got very alarmed about our dependence on the internet and the digital realm, how much of our economy, knowledge, if you think of us at home, how many of our photographs and our videos and our lives are in this thing called the cloud. And if something went wrong with it, we would be lost. Most of us don't know how to read a map anymore. We rely on satellite navigation. And so that became my calamity. So now I had the two things, the idea of people looking into the past and the thing that had happened to us.
And so in the book, they have this almost ye olde world. They're speaking in a language that is...
from the King James Bible. You know.
Right. And you're not allowed, is it, talk about or refer to or get involved in too much excavation of the past 800 years ago when it was 2012 with this arrogant, or 2019, I should say, with this arrogant generation or arrogant people?
I think hubristic, actually. I mean, you know, the taking the symbol of the bitten apple, which is a symbol of terrific heresy, and, you know,
Why?
Using it... From the Garden of Eden, you know, that the serpent, you know, they eat the apple and then they become too aware and calamity follows. So the fact that Apple should have taken that as their logo, put it on every device, strikes my characters 800 years in the future. It's just an incredible illustration of arrogance. And
I made no correlation to the biblical reference, but it makes great sense.
So they and of course the world has gone back to the King James Bible, and there are no words for technology and computers and so on. Yeah. So the church, rather like the party in 1984 with Newspeak, the language controls the thought, and there aren't the words for the world as it used to be.
I spoke to CNN's Jim Acosta this week, and we began our conversation by talking about 1984 by George Orwell. Why is there an Orwellian shadow cast over this modern period of our history?
I think because it's such a brilliant book, he nailed certain things, which is just sort of universal, and the surveillance society, and the idea that you can twist truth. I mean, it's all about fake news, really. It's 2 + 2 = 5.
You're right.
If the party says that, that's the truth.
Yeah, and if a Sharpie pen shows it covers Alabama.
Exactly.
The storm's coming for Alabama.
Yeah, don't argue with it. The only thing that he got wrong, I think, which is one of the things that in the Second Sleep, is that the church, even in war, wrote to him and said, I really think your book is great, but there's one mistake.
Yeah.
You miss out the church. And ignore the supernatural element if you want. As an institution, I don't think it would disappear in the way you obliterated it in 1984. I think that's true. And so in my novel, the church is central once again.
There's a piece in it when Shadwell, who's the great heretic as well, he says, we all know that almost every person, he's referring 800 years into the future, back to now, that every person, including children, was issued with a device that enabled them to see and hear one another, however far apart in the world they might be, and that these devices were small enough to be carried in the palm of one's hand, that they gave instant access to all the knowledge and music and opinions and writings in the world, and that in due course they displaced human memory and reasoning and even normal social intercourse, an enfeebling and narcotic power that some say drove their possessors mad, to the extent that their introduction marked the beginning of the end of advanced civilization. It's a beautiful thing. Talk to me about that paragraph.
Well, I think that, I'm quite serious, to be honest about it. I think it's changed who we are and how we interact with one another. I think in particular, you could notice it with your kids. The anxiety that's spread by social media, the lack of attention span. It's no accident that the purveyors of this narcotic, bosses of Silicon Valley, don't allow their own children often to have these devices. You know, they're like dealers in crack cocaine who, they live in the smart end of town and they're prepared to sell it to others. So I think it is quite dangerous. I mean, there's obviously wonderful benefits from it, but the power of this thing we carry around with us, which we call a phone, but it isn't really a phone, is it? It's 10 times, 100 times a phone, is changing the way we interact with one another, possibly the way we think, and it's undermining all our institutions and our democracy, you know, the idea of commonly shared facts, agreed facts, which is the basis of a democracy. Because we all have our own little device now, we can all get the news we want, we simply don't believe the other side, whatever they say. And that is doing a lot of damage as well, I think.
Your father was a printer, is that right, in Nottingham?
Yep.
And he came from a generation, I think, because we were talking about this a bit earlier on, about self-sustaining the consumer society, pick it up, throw it away, filling land banks full of clothes we don't need, and so on and so forth. And he would have been able to strip down the engine of a car and put it back together again without thinking or blinking. Probably could do a lot more besides.
Yeah, and a lot of dads, you know, when I was growing up, they were all you saw was their feet poking out from under the car all weekend.
They knew how to do stuff.
They knew how to do it, and they had to do it because they didn't have the money for anyone else to do it.
Right.
My mother repaired clothes and that sort of thing.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't, as you say, a disposable society. People could function and had to because they hadn't got much money. Nowadays, you couldn't even possibly begin to repair a modern car because there's so much electronics in it.
Now, and again, equally, that comes down to clothes or fixing, you know, the fridge is broken, get a new one.
Yeah.
You know, rather than tinkering.
Yeah, your fridge is linked. Your fridge is a computer linked to the internet. Yeah. I mean, it's a very... And all this is fine as long as it works properly. But if something was to go wrong with it, we could be in a lot of trouble. And we know, actually, states are planting viruses in one another's systems as a form of cyber warfare. And one of the things that the Brexit debate has brought home to people in Britain is how this just-in-time supply, you know, that your supermarkets are, they don't have a big warehouse attached to them. They're just shelves, and all the food is in lorries on the road. So any interruption to that, a huge city like London, is said to be six meals away from starvation. You know, the average household now only contains enough food for about 2 days. We're used to Deliveroo and all these sorts of things. So we're really dependent on this technology, and any interruption to it, just imagine in your own life within 72 hours where you might be.
But we watched the news last night, and Yellowhammer's... that extraordinary
document. You could have called the book Yellowhammer,
the second hammer. And you really could, because you saw the trucks, and they're saying, if those trucks don't come and they don't go, and the next thing you know, it's food shortages, civil unrest. Like, language I had to second... You take a second look at.
Quite. The first paragraph in this book has the word curfew in it.
Right.
And actually, the British government is talking about possibly introducing a curfew. I mean, this is absolutely crazy. You know, it's unplugging yourself from the modern world. They've made the discovery, astonishingly, that Britain is an island. Who knew?
You know, there's something else. We'll come back to all of that, the politics of that. But the Roman trilogy, among my favourite books, captures that what we can only imagine was the sense of the greatness and the grandeur of Rome. And even still, I was there during the summer, the Roman Forum, and you have to close your eyes and smell the dust and the heat and try and picture the majesty of it. But we have brittle buildings left behind. As a reminder of what was amazing. Do you see a correlation between the extraordinary nature of ancient Rome, the aqueducts, the viaducts, the innovation of buildings and roads and so on, to our cyber version, possibly, of what they did, and then with that, the fall of ancient Rome and the potential collapse of this, arguably, hurtling towards a more hubristic end?
Yeah, I mean, you know, civilizations come to an end. They all do. The Mayan civilization in Central America collapsed. It had 40 cities in Central America, and it disappeared within a generation. Nobody knows why. The Romans, Rome was sacked in 451 AD, and they withdrew the legions from Britain. And the ruins were still visible 300 years later of the great villas and so on, but nobody knew how to make them work. Nobody knew how the central heating worked. Nobody could. The roads were no longer being maintained. The paradox is that because the Romans built so brilliantly of stone and concrete, what they left behind endured. And so, actually, if you go to Rome, the Pantheon still stands after 2,000 years, and modern civil engineers are not sure to this day how they built it.
Colosseum,
the Mulvian Bridge, where Cicero arrested the Catiline conspirators.
Yeah.
There's still cars going over it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, their technology was stunning. Our problem is that so much of our wealth and energy is now digitalized and is in cyberspace. So much of our economy has migrated there, that we aren't making things of that level of permanence, and a modern skyscraper is concrete, steel, and glass. The glass cracks, the elements get in, vegetation gets in, the concrete cladding is attacked, and once water reaches the tubes of steel inside the actual skeleton of the building, they oxidize and expand, the concrete cracks, and the whole thing collapses. So 150 years tops for a modern building. Leave behind?
That is a great parlor game in some ways. What will survive all of this?
Nappies.
Sad to say, as you describe that in the book, this morass of flotsam and plastic
Caribbean, huge area of floating plastic, and it's still there 800 years on. In my book,
if Churchill was Augustus, is Johnson Caligula?
Well, you know...
Which one is... I mean, what is Boris Johnson?
Well, yes, that is a question that it's hard to answer. I mean, he loves ancient Rome.
He does. And he wrote a very fine book on Churchill.
But he's sort of a... He's like a sort of tribute, very, very bad Churchill tribute band playing lonely pubs on a Friday night. Can't quite bring it off. A faint echo of what the original was like.
And in terms of imperial comparisons, who would you put him on a par with?
Oh, a certain element of Nero, isn't there? Self-regard and fiddling as the nation burns.
Now, this from a former political editor of The Observer and Labour Party, dare I say it, activist. So when they start writing in to say, you know, stop bashing Boris, he's doing a great job, stop bashing Trump, he's an extraordinary leader, what's your response to people who feel that you're the part of, you know, what they call in America the East, the coastal elite, the intellectual snobs? What do you say to people who say you're alienating people like us?
Well, I think that point's well taken, actually. And nothing is new. I mean, those Cicero books are all about unscrupulous, very wealthy members of the elite themselves mm-hmm. whipping up popular distrust and feeling against the elite of the Senate and bringing it down and the political system collapsing as a result. And, you know, we're seeing something similar to that now. There's a lot of discontent around and they're playing on it quite brilliantly, facilitated by social media, in particular, yes. Obviously, with the case of Trump, his tweeting is to death.
You said recently, which was great, you said everything can be known on your phone. And that's why, how do you make historical fiction, or I don't even know if this is science fiction, but whatever it is, it's a genre busting, as I heard somebody describe it recently. And you said it's quite hard, you have to make it feel immediate, like CNN or like a news channel, you've got to keep punching the storyline out. And you posited the idea of, think of a Jane Austen novel. Could you share that with us?
Well, it's simply that this access to constant, instant information means that when Mrs. Bennet learned that the smart people had moved in up the road, you know, Mr. Darcy and the rest, she just simply Googled them. So there would have been the story would have been over in the first two sentences.
Google Darcy.
Know. Yeah. One of the great things about writing this novel, actually, yes. set in the future, that is all about technology, is there is no damn technology in it, so everyone's on horseback and it's candlelight and it moves at a stately pace across Exmoor and small villages, and I don't have to grapple with this thing, which is death to a modern detective writer or thriller writer, that everybody knows every damn thing before they leave the room. You know, I used to love those scenes of going to newspaper archives and going through them and gumshoe, you know. No need for it now.
I wonder, do we still need a bit of it? Because if the fake news is cyber, maybe eventually we'll have to return to the physicality of the gumshoe search.
Yeah.
Because we have written down evidence, because everything gets deleted. Whereas you have to go back to, I'm being hopeful in my...
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think...
Archives and so on.
And in the end, people are people, you know. Everything changes around us, technology, society, the politics. But the basic human instincts, they remain the same, whether it's now or Cicero's Rome, in my view.
Therese has been on. Just some text, Robert Harris, who's live in studio with us this morning. Quick text for Robert, just to say how much I love his books, especially the Cicero trilogy. Couldn't put them down. Looking forward to the second sleep for my holidays next month. Great, you're going to love it. Greg says, bought the second sleep last Friday after hearing a recommendation of it on your show. I have read several of Robert's books. Was surprised by this one. It was fascinating. Read it on Saturday. Couldn't put it down. Please ask him when the second sleep... please ask him when the second sleep... because you do leave it hanging on... I mean, there's got to be more to this.
Yeah, well, oddly enough, it's been optioned by the TV company that made Downton Abbey, and they have an idea that they want to make several series, so that they'll take my novel, which is just set over 6 days, but they will then take the characters and the world and explore
wonderful
it further.
News.
So that would be good, and I'd be involved in that, and I think that's interesting.
There's more to
concept.
Come. No question about it. Joe in Dublin wants to know, could you ask Robert what Cicero would do about Brexit? Do you ever think about that?
Yeah, what would he have done? There's little doubt he would have been regarded as a member of the elite, if anyone was, Cicero was. And I think that, you know, his whole political shtick was whatever is best for the country, and that a politician, a statesman, was like a doctor, and that their job was to treat the body politic and to do the best to ensure the most happiness and welfare for the majority of the citizens. So, you know, that would have been his course. Having said that, of course, he was highly patriotic and not averse to a bit of tub-thumping himself.
Indeed.
So I wouldn't like to call what he would have said about Brexit.
Barry's in BlackRock, he says, wanted to thank Robert for Fatherland. I thought it was very clever, superb. One of the first books of fiction I read and have recommended it to many. Thanks again. More like that, please. Teresa's in Cork, halfway through The Second Sleep, loving it. Easy to read. And every now and again I stop and I think, and I need to... I stop and I think, I need to learn how to grow vegetables. Knowledge alters everything, you say in page 62, yet the vested interest blocking the climate change reality is more scary now. Fiction yet again hitting the home truths squarely. Bravo, Robert Harris. How true, says another, those words are about phones and new technology. We've forgotten how to use our primary computer, the brain. And we're all going along with the whole thing. It's madness. Don't forget, some of us are still, says another, out there who don't have a smartphone and aren't on social media. We are not under the malign spell of IT, says Kate. Just bought the book on my phone from Amazon with one-click ordering. The irony. For the text. And another says, Robert is right. I used to be able to impart knowledge to younger people and they would gaze in wonder at my wisdom. Now, no matter what I say, there's always at least one who immediately Googles my pronouncements and challenges their veracity by nitpicking some little aspects. So now I don't bother. It's a bit defeatist.
Yes, that's a
shame.
Yeah.
But it is. I mean, I drive along the motorway every morning, and my latest thing is to watch bus stops and to see how many heads are down in the phone, and not, no one's talking to the other person, no one's looking out at the world, and I can guarantee you, Robert, if there's six people at a bus stop, there's six heads down.
Yeah, and worse even than that, I think, is when you go to a restaurant and see a family out together for a meal, and almost all of their, again, the heads are bowed as if in prayer over this small device. It's about 5 years ago, you used to hear people saying, put that down, you know, yeah. And that seems to have stopped now because it's like the invasion of the body snatchers. It's got everybody now, even the mum and dad who used to say to the kids, stop doing that. Now they're equally hooked.
Yes.
I find it myself. I mean, I'm not trying to be snooty about it. We're all the same, I think.
Sadly. But I did find in The Second Sleep myself slightly envious of the simplicity of the pastoral life. I did. Like that lady talking about, I want to grow vegetables. Back to your dad and stripping an engine. I think that I'd love to kind of try and re-engage a bit.
Yeah, well, and maybe we'll do that. Maybe there will be a back to nature kind of movement will arise in, not just out of fears of climate change, but out of... increasing alarm about what the technology is doing to us. It's a hard struggle in this novel in 800 years in the future. You know, life is tough and it's gone back to a kind of, there's no great medicines, there's no, you know, but there is this sense of a small, tight community and that everybody knows everybody and there's more human interaction, I think.
If I was to talk to you in a year or 18 months, what do you think in terms of Brexit, Britain, Boris, anything else beginning with B?
Yeah, bollocks. I'm allowed to say that. Sorry,
you said,
I apologise.
Isn't it funny how that tipped off the tongue?
Yes.
As a natural quartet.
Yes, it did. I take that back. Forgive me.
Too late.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I think that do you know, it's now 3.5 years nearly since that referendum. Mm. The closer it's supposed to come, the further it recedes. It keeps going back and back and back over the horizon. And the real original sin in this is that the people that won the referendum, the Brexiteers, as a tactic, made a deliberate choice not to say exactly what it was that they wanted. They said, we're just going to issue an instruction to the government. It's not our job to put it into effect. This is what we want. And the truth is, that is totally specious. You can't do that. You've got to say what it is you want. Do you want to be like Norway or do you want a total break? And they can't make up their own mind. And nobody really, I mean, I say nobody, a third of the country probably is willing to take the hardship and take the severance. But there isn't a majority in the country, and there isn't a majority in Parliament. So unless they start to compromise, I don't think they'll ever get it, quite frankly.
We watch interesting times, to say the very least. Robert Harris, author of The Second Sleeping, marvellous, marvellous book. Loved it so much, and I'm a great fan of what you do. So thanks for coming in to see us this morning.
My pleasure, Ryan. Thanks so
much. Always good to see you. Robert Harris, at 12 minutes to 10, we have more for you after this.